This is KTOO. I'm Jamie Deep, here with local and statewide news. Juneau resident Hune Lance Twitchell won an Emmy Saturday for Not a Mascot, an episode he wrote for the TV show Molly of Denali. Juneau residents welcomed Twitchell at the airport Sunday night with song and dance. A supporter shared this audio. The winning episode follows the show's main character, Molly Mabray, as she learns that a competing basketball team has a mascot based on Indigenous stereotypes. She then helps the team find a new mascot. This is the second Emmy nomination from Twitchell and his first award. Wearing a Chilkat robe, Twitchell thanked his supporters at the airport and said they can accomplish great things together.
I am so thankful for this opportunity to stand on the backs of all the storytellers who brought us here. All the people who work on this wonderful show. It takes so many hands to do something like this.
Twitchell is also an author and a professor of Alaska Native Languages at the University of Alaska Southeast. Molly of Denali received a nomination for Outstanding Interactive Media this year as well. This is the show's first Emmy Award. You can listen to a longer conversation between Twitchell and Juneau Afternoon host Boston Christopher at ktoo.org. And Sitka's planned internet outage was shorter than predicted. The internet company GCI announced this morning that it completed repairs to the fiber optic cable that provides internet and cellular service to most of Sitka. Many Sitkans have had limited internet access since last Thursday morning when GCI switched over to a backup system that provided basic call and text service while it made repairs to the subsea cable. A statement GCI released today thanked customers for their patience and said that a month of free internet would be credited to accounts automatically. It's the second time in months that the community has been without internet. Without notice, in August, Sitka went offline for 17 days after a break in the subsea cable. Limits on Alaska's commercial fisheries were established in the early 1970s to ensure the industry could sustain itself. But researchers and Sea Alaska shareholders say that's backfired in rural Native villages, where many family-run boats have raised their hooks and nets for good. And as KTOO's Alex Solomon reports, they're calling for change.
A half century ago, Angoon's Harbor was packed with small, family-operated boats that caught fish on hook and line, called trolling, or with a big net called a purse seine. Salmon and halibut fed mouths and bank accounts. Peter Duncan, mayor of Angoon, remembers those days. But it's not the same anymore. He says that fisheries regulations have caused
devastating changes. You just don't find a troller in our harbors anymore.
He says that's made people more dependent on government help, like food stamps. Duncan grew up fishing on his father's seiner in the small Tlingit village on Admiralty Island. He graduated to his own troll boat and commercially fished until the early 1990s, when he says he couldn't make a living that way anymore. Folks weren't catching enough salmon to make money, so permits became more valuable to sell. Many of those permits left the island, and with them went the means for the village to sustain itself.
It's sad to know that at one time, we used to be, you know, a strong fishing fleet that took pride in going up and going fishing.
Duncan's story isn't unique. This reality has unfolded in most rural villages throughout the Gulf of Alaska, as first reported by the Northern Journal. In part, it's an unintended consequence of a law that took effect in 1975 called the Limited Entry Act, which allowed the state to issue a set number of permits for each fishery. The goal was to address a sustainability problem. At the time, salmon populations were plummeting, while commercial fishermen multiplied. The idea was simple: cap the number of people fishing, and there will be enough to go around. But that's not what happened in Native villages. Courtney Carruthers, an environmental anthropologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, led a study of more than 3,000 Sea Alaska shareholders and descendants about the community impacts of fisheries limitation policies. She found that Sea Alaska villages owned half as many fishing vessels in 2019 than they owned in 1978, and commercial salmon permits had dwindled by more than a third since 1975.
This is not good public policy if our communities in the Gulf of Alaska, surrounded by the ocean with, you know, thousands of years of fishing knowledge and history, within one generation are cut out. I mean, this is an absolute crisis.
Joe Nelson is interim president of the Sea Alaska Corporation, representing Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian interests in Southeast Alaska. His airy corner office in downtown Juneau looks out over Gastineau Channel. Clouds trundle into the snowy peaks of Douglas Island. Glossy magazine copies of Carruthers' study are spread out on a table. The report points to a loss of fishing access as one of the main reasons people leave their rural villages.
It's all been going one way, and that's migration out of most of the fleet and most of the permits.
That out-migration, he says, leads to schools and other services closing down. Those who stay behind are aging out of the industry without enough young people to pick it up, he says.
So the whole economy just shrinks. It's much bigger than a single fisherman that decides not to show up anymore.
Nelson says that the state needs to tweak the limited entry system so that Native communities can fish commercially without going bankrupt. When limited entry started, the price to fish for salmon skyrocketed from hundreds of dollars to thousands.
So today, a seine permit in Southeast Alaska is worth about $140,000, and a drift permit is worth about $44,000.
Those numbers vary, depending on how well a fishery is doing. Johnson says that while the Limited Entry Act helped make Alaska's fisheries more sustainable, it created this new problem. Now, the commission is talking internally about potential solutions.
Such as making it administratively easier to transfer a permit to another rural resident in the same area that you live in.
Researchers say there could be room for creating a new class of permit, such as an entry-level or small-scale permit, to get people started. But any changes would have to come through the state legislature. There's also a potential federal pathway for recognizing indigenous rights to fish, which were not compensated through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. SeaLaska is not advocating for specific policy changes just yet. Nelson says there must be open public discussions that look at the slew of ideas. But first, he wants state officials to recognize that there is a problem. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
And Alaska State Development Agency says it's talking with the operator of the Ketchikan shipyard to resolve a dispute that threatens the future of the key local employer. That comes about 2 weeks after the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, told shipyard operator Vigor that it would not renew its contract to run the multi-million-dollar state facility. ADA and Vigor said Vigor had not supported enough jobs, made enough money for the state, or adequately contributed to repairs and maintenance. The agency said the operator's time at the yard would end November 30th. Now, though, tensions appear to be easing. A joint statement from ADA and Vigor says the two are, quote, united in their commitment to preserving this essential shipyard. Both say they're working together on ways to extend their working relationship by exploring new opportunities to better serve the state's maritime needs. Neither side offered any details on what had changed in the meantime. Previously, ADA said it was willing to discuss extending the end of the contract to March of next year, but there's no mention of the March deadline in Thursday's statement, indicating the pair may be negotiating a longer-term deal. ADA and Vigor say they're optimistic about the shipyard's future and its enduring role in the region. They say they'll provide further updates in the near future as negotiations continue. And Juneau community members gathered for a candlelight vigil for missing and murdered Indigenous people on Thursday. It was a space for healing after the remains of a missing Indigenous teenager were found in Arizona last month. That loss touched an emotion that crosses state boundaries, the loss that Indigenous communities everywhere feel about their relatives who are victimized by violence. KTOO's Yvonne Krumry has more.
We will never stop saying their names.
A fire crackles as dozens of people gather under a lunar eclipse at the Kisei Healing Kutia, a totem pole carved for healing from gender-based violence. Hitl'ish Lyle James, Tlingit advocate and leader, reads the names of Indigenous women and children who've been murdered or who disappeared.
The most recent. Repeat after me, Emily Pike.
Emily Pike.
Say her name.
Emily Pike was 14 years old when she went missing from her group home in Arizona in January. Her remains were found a month later. This tragic story isn't an uncommon one. Indigenous women and girls in the United States are three times as likely to be murdered than white women and girls. For that reason, the news touched members of the Juneau community who gathered here to honor, remember, and heal.
We've always known this, that when we speak their names, they're standing with us.
James also named Ashley Johnson Barr, a 10-year-old girl who was kidnapped and murdered in Kotzebue in 2018. And Tracy Day, a Juneau Tlingit woman who's been missing since 2019. James introduces a song called Ich Hat Dut Litzin. It means you are precious.
All of you standing here this evening are precious. All our loved ones that we lost too early, they are precious.
He says that the song is for them. Attendees holding drums get ready for the song, and he teaches the words before it starts, so the group can sing loudly together. He invites all to dance.
And when you dance, stomp it into the ground, because we are tired of all our relatives disappearing. And no explanation. No justice for our loved ones. We are their voices. You are their voices. You are their strength. Hey, yeah.
They dance under a kutia carved by master carver Wayne Price. It was raised in 2022 at Twin Lakes to be a symbol of healing from domestic violence and child abuse.
It's a totem that probably shouldn't ever have to be built.
People burn cedar chips in a small fire. Price carved the chips out of a dugout canoe, and each one represents a victim of violence. The ceremony is meant to heal the community.
You know, that's what we're here, because we believe it's going to work.
Kaylin Schneider is the daughter of Tracy Day, a Tlingit woman who's been missing in Juneau for 6 years. She said the kutia is a space for the families of missing and murdered Indigenous people who don't have answers.
There are so many family members that, like my mom's case, we don't have a gravesite. We have nowhere to mourn our loved one, you know? So I think this is really special.
And she says hearing her mother's name lets her know the people in Juneau haven't forgotten about her. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
This is KTOO.